As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Total Soccer Show and our latest round of listener questions. On today's show, we'll be predicting big relegations, talking about tall players, and hopping in the time machine once again to add national team legends to our respective national teams. La-di-da. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, a man who's been playing a game of Owl or Chupacabra. Taylor Rockwell, please explain yourself.
We have owls in our backyard in the woods behind our house, and they, turns out, sound terrifying and make weird noises that aren't just like the cute hoot hoot that you would expect from children's cartoons. Instead, they make bizarre noises that have me wondering if it's an owl or a supernatural creature. I would kind of be okay if it were Chupacabra or the Loch Ness Monster or any other mythical creatures. They're all welcome.
You got Mulder and Scully on the case?
Always. You got to. I mean, I'm not sure what else they're up to, so why not?
Indeed. Joining us, Tay-Tay, a man who has things to say about the 2026 World Cup final potentially being at SoFi Stadium, Joe Lowry. Hello.
Sorry, I just can't get over, Taylor, I saw that tweet from you last night, and isn't Chupacabra, doesn't Ben Wyatt end up saying that a lot in Parks and Rec when he's like, there's some line in Parks and Rec, and I'm trying to remember what it is, where that character just says that word over and over again in a strange voice, and it's driving me insane. Anyway, Ryan.
Ooh, that does sound familiar. You are correct.
I think it might be when he's like panicked because he gets weird around policemen and things like that. I don't know what it is, but it doesn't
matter. It's either that or the episode where he gets drunk on blueberry wine. It's one or the other, but yes, either way, I think that is a thing that he does.
Maybe a listener will know. If so, please tweet at us, and I'll feel a lot better about myself. Ryan, yeah, watching that game, some of the League's Cup showcase, I think that's what it was. Not really very clear why LAFC and the Galaxy were playing teams from Liga MX, but they were at SoFi Stadium last night, the first games ever at SoFi Stadium, and the field was narrow. I tweeted about it, and people were kind enough to inform me that it does look like there's going to be about $100 million spent on widening that field. And we were talking a little bit before we started recording. That's not the simplest process, but I think it is an important one if there are going to be big World Cup games played at SoFi in 2026, and the same will go for a few other NFL stadiums if that needs to happen. But I learned something from Twitter last night, and that doesn't happen a whole lot.
Oh, that's good to know, Joe. I imagine if they're going to expand it and spend $100 million on it, they're just going to have a bunch of guys just push the stands on each side to make it a bit wider. Is that what they're going to do?
They're just going to squish the stadiums in on themselves. Yeah, the stands on it on themselves. I think that's exactly what's going to happen.
Excellent stuff, Joe. Joining us, rounding out our pack, a man who's buying a Nottingham Forest brand new third kit, released today as we record, and there's a chance he's going to get jizz on it. Graham Ruthven, hello.
Oh, no, I should have known that you would somehow get a jizz Hornkamp pun into today's show. You were the first person that I thought of, Ryan, after I saw that jizz is on his way to the Premier League. Take that as you will.
Yeah, Jiz Hornkamp, the Dutch striker, linked with Nottingham Forest as we speak. And I know, Graham, you're expecting me to come on here with loads and loads of jizz puns. And frankly, there's jizz all over my timeline right now. It's everywhere. But I'm not feeling that spunky today. I'm not going to be jostling for those kinds of sticky situations today, Graham.
Oh, wow.
You can rest assured, okay?
Okay, Ryan Bailey. I'm reeling after that. But I should have expected it.
Did you get it all out, Ryan?
Yeah, I think it's all out now. It's all out, Tate. Listener, that's the most jizz fun you'll have today outside of incognito mode, I promise you. Let's go on with listener questions, shall we? Plenty to be getting on with. Adam Fominoa.
Are you just going to talk over this one? You're not going to acknowledge the weirdness of this owl noise? Come on now.
That's what that is?
Oh my god. That is the owl. Exactly. Is that an
that's
owl
terrifying.
Or chupacabra? You tell
or
me.
Or is it a dog? I burned down the house. Time to move, Taylor. Sorry.
And that's coming from Graham. Graham is telling me to burn down the house. Now I'm concerned.
Oh, boy. Yeah, my house physically attacks me and throws me into walls, but that is something else.
Graham, now you understand why I was freaked out in the middle of the night.
Yeah, the Glasgow vigilantes are going to be over to make sure everything's okay, Taylor, I think is what's going to happen here.
That was
interesting. Adam Fominoa has got a question for us. What is the biggest club in Europe you think could reasonably be relegated at some point in the next 10 years? Loves the
My
show.
Aid.
Keep doing what you're doing, says Adam. What's that, Graham?
Just said Manchester United, sorry.
Yeah, I thought you did. You want to explain yourself?
Bad. Not going well.
I mean, you say it as a joke, but Man United have not been a top flight team forever. I think, was it the 80s they were last time they were down? Things, stranger things have happened, Graham.
Yeah, Dennis Law relegated them. Dennis Law, obviously one of their best ever player. There's a statue of Dennis Law outside Old Trafford, the Holy Trinity statue, and he relegated them. He was playing for Manchester City at the time, and he scored a winner on the last day of the season for City to send Manchester City down. So maybe that's what's going to happen here. Ronaldo's going to sign for City this summer, and then he's going to relegate Manchester United.
So much narrative. Graham, is there any other nominations for the next decade? Do you think any teams, maybe any other Premier League teams, who could be reasonably relegated, do we think?
Yeah, so I am going to leave the obvious answer here because I feel like others may have stuff to say about some other North West Premier League clubs that might be relegated at some point in the next 10 years. But I'm actually going to head to Spain and I'm going to nominate Valencia. So considering the struggles they've had over the last decade and a half, it's kind of remarkable that Valencia haven't actually been relegated recently. They're obviously one of the biggest clubs in Spain. Traditionally, they're a third or fourth force behind Barcelona and Real Madrid. They won the Liga in 2004, so not that long ago. But since then, it's just been kind of crisis after crisis financially. It seems like they're always just 2 or 3 years away from oblivion. This summer has been another difficult one for them. They've barely spent anything in the transfer market, and that's after a couple years of selling their best players on the cheap just to stay afloat. They've got a very unpopular owner who makes rash decisions, Peter Lim. He sacked Marcelino just a couple seasons back. They actually had a good manager and were doing relatively okay. They won the Copa del Rey and they got back in the Champions League. And then Peter Lim sacked Marcelino just a few months after that. And this season, they have Gennaro Gattuso as their new manager. Maybe not the sort of character you want going into a volatile situation. I actually don't think Valencia will get relegated this season. But if the sort of struggles they've been having continue, you'd have to think, by the law of averages, at some point in the next 10 years, they will be a threat.
Peter Lim also hired Gary Neville, Graham. We have to think about that.
Exactly. And Phil Neville.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Let's keep it in Spain, Graham. Is it crazy to suggest Barcelona? Not necessarily for sporting reasons, but let's bear in mind, last year, they were technically bankrupt in the first quarter of the year. There was reports that their chief executive, Ferran Reverter, he said the club would have been dissolved last April if it were a PLC, because it had been taken to such terrible financial places by the previous board. I mean, they are playing with fire quite a bit. You could see in the next few years, Graham, potentially financial mismanagement, maybe just bringing Barcelona out of the Liga for the first time. But I mean, they are an institution. You'd think they'd be protected against that kind of thing. But weirder things have happened. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, people said that about Rangers in Scotland. That's the road you're going down here, isn't it? The kind of financial oblivion relegation. Everyone said there's no way Rangers will go down. Similar sort of situation in Scotland to Spain, where, you know, you have two dominant forces who just kind of share the league titles amongst themselves. And Rangers got kicked out of the Scottish League system and then forced to reapply in the bottom tier because they went into liquidation. So I guess it's a possibility, but it feels like Joan Laporta is pulling so many levers at the moment and selling so much of the family silver that might be more than 10 years off. But maybe 11 or 12, maybe as soon as those 10 years are over, maybe Barcelona are in Segunda Division.
So many levers, so little time. Let's bring in Taylor Rockwell for his perspective on this question.
Actually, I wanted to ask Graham another question. Graham, was the Manchester United one more a joke, or do you actually feel like they could be? Because I think my answer to this question is fairly boring, because barring match-fixing scandals or financial scandals, I don't see many of the like Super League clubs and clubs in that sort of stratosphere actually being at threat of relegation. I feel like they're almost too big to fail. Famous last words there. So do you feel like Manchester United really could?
No, not really. I think it would take a string of catastrophic decisions, mm-hmm. and obviously there's been some bad decisions, but you look at how bad Manchester United were last season, their worst ever points tally in the Premier League era, and they still finished sixth.
Yeah.
So there is quite a big cushion from where they are to the relegation zone, and even 10 years plotting out, I think the next 10 years could be quite difficult for Manchester United, but I'd be surprised if they're anywhere close to relegation.
So that's kind of how I feel about them. Like, and I think about like Chelsea in the second Jose Mourinho tenure, when they had an absolutely atrocious season. Everything was wrong. They were losing. It felt like every single game, and I think at worst they were in maybe 13th when he was sacked. And so a team like that, like if you're talking about Bournemouth losing a bunch of games and there being a bunch of discontent and the manager leaving, that feels like they are nailed on for the bottom of the table. But when you have the resources of some of the larger clubs and the talent in that squad, yeah. a lot of times I think the talent is enough to get you through that season. So I think there's that aspect of it. I also think there are clubs that are so massive, honestly, like to their countries, and not just to like the league itself, but to the actual economy of the league. I have to think a ton of tourism to Barcelona. Barcelona, a beautiful city with lots of tourist destinations. But Barcelona, the club, is one of them, is chief among them, I would argue. And so I think there is a vested interest in not letting those teams have that level of crisis. I don't know how you could rectify that if Barcelona continued to pull those levers and suddenly had nothing else to sell. And they themselves, I think I'm correct in saying by the structure, Barcelona, Real Madrid, the same, can't be acquired. It would require all of the voting members to agree to sell to an individual, and I don't think that would ever reach a majority level. So I think that could maybe be it, is like way down the road, if they really do sell all of their assets, Barcelona, and aren't able to get out of the financial hole, maybe that's where they could have some issues. But short of that, I think the biggest clubs that I had on my list were similar to Valencia, teams that have sort of already proven themselves to struggle and have some issues making the best decisions, like Hertha Berlin, and I would say like Everton. I'm guessing that's who Graham was alluding to earlier. Everton is one that does seem like if some things do not go well for them this season, they might be in some trouble, and maybe that continues on from this point.
Taylor, building on your Barcelona point there, I think we might only be a couple of years away from Barcelona just turning themselves into an NFT, like as a club, like the whole thing, maybe just playing NFT games. So that could cause them to crash and be relegated.
I mean, NFT company literally bought 25% of Barcelona Studios, I think it was last week, and they have turned Johan Cruyff into an NFT as well. So you're not far away from that actually being a reality already.
Oh boy.
That hurt my soul a little bit hearing you say what you just said. Oh, yeah. I'm guessing Johan Cruyff wouldn't love that. He's chain smoking in his grave right now out of frustration.
He went for about 600 grand, if it's any consolation, if I can remember correctly, on that
sale.
That was
my first reaction as well, as that Cruyff will be turning in his grave. But Cruyff actually may have been at the front of the NFT the NFT scam, because he was always quick. Was he not one of the first players to have an agent? And obviously there was the Puma Adidas thing as well. So maybe he'd be an NFT bro.
He'd be hawking crypto right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Joe, anything to add to this question?
There's one more that I don't think anybody's mentioned yet, and that's Schalke. This is kind of cheating because they just got back up, but they're a massive club. I went through and looked at I was trying to figure out how to judge biggest, right? We all have this sort of nebulous idea of which clubs are big and which clubs are not. That's mostly based on history, I think, and maybe some element of recent success than anything else. But I went and looked at Yahoo Finance and looked at, you know, clubs that are making a lot of money, or at least generating a lot of money, if not a lot of that money turning into profit. So this was from 2020. It's a little outdated at this point, but I thought it was still a useful data point. Schalke, from this article in 2020, had the 16th most revenue that year with $267.9 million. That's a lot of money that went down to the second Bundesliga. They won promotion last year after winning the second Bundesliga, but I think they absolutely have a chance to go back down this year. We don't need to wait 10 years, as Adam said in his question. I think they could be going back and forth a little bit more until they can generate some stability. But I think Schalke, along with a lot of the other clubs you've said, that have been said, big clubs. I don't think Manchester United or Barcelona or Chelsea are ever going to get relegated probably at this point. But clubs like Everton and Schalke and Hertha Berlin, those ones definitely could.
Adam Fominaya, thank you very much for that question. Let's go to Anthony Vladivia, who says, if you could add any national team legend in their prime to your current national team's pool of players, who would you add and why? I've got to say, Taylor, I really struggled with this question, but I'll go to you first.
So I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. I'm picking a U.S. national team legend to put on the current U.S. national team, right?
Sí.
All right, because originally when I read this, I thought you can pick any national team legend, and I would have added Harry Kane. I think he makes the United States way better right away. Since I cannot do that, I think there are two sort of obvious names for the current U.S. men's national team. Brian McBride seems like he should be in there, but I honestly do not remember enough about Brian McBride's game to know if he can do some of the things that Greg Berhalter would be asking, which is a strange thing to say about a person who is now, I guess, technically Greg Berhalter's boss. But I think he's very coachable, but I don't have Brian McBride on my list. I instead have the obvious one, Jozy Altidore. I think capable of operating deeper, which is what we've come to expect from that number nine spot, but then can also obviously score some goals, handle the physicality, can hold up, can be good, like can win in the air, and I think would offer a lot to this current U.S. team. And I also think it would be lovely if he could, because obviously the U.S. missed out on 2018. 2014, Jozy has the hamstring injury and doesn't play at all. I think he gets injured before the tournament and maybe gets hurt in that first game. And then in 2010, though he starts, I believe, every single game, doesn't score. And I think a lot of that was sort of the U.S. figuring things out as they went. They always had to make changes at halftime, but it's also the injury to Charlie Davies. They had built such a strong relationship. When Davies gets injured, it's Robbie Finlay who replaces him, and there's just not that same connection. Bob Bradley chops and changes throughout the tournament to find a better combo, but isn't able to do so. And so Jozy, I think, doesn't end up scoring, which means I think he doesn't score at any World Cup, and I don't like that. So I think Jozy coming in could get some goals for this U.S. team, has a ton of talent around him that can also create and provide him with some good chances, and I think that would be a good one. The other one, if not Jozy, I know he's not really a number nine. I don't think of him as a striker, but I feel like Clint Dempsey just automatically makes this team better. Clint Dempsey in his prime could score some goals and do some things.
Taylor, the question said, if you could add any national team legend, and you went with you led with Jozy Altidore, with all due respect, did you understand the assignment?
I mean, if you think about strikers for the U.S., like out-and-out number nines, there are not that many when it comes to legendary status. I think Eric Winalda is probably on that list. I think Brian McBride is certainly on that list. And then I think it's probably Jozy Altidore is probably our third best number nine of all time. Because as I said, I don't think of Clint Dempsey primarily as a striker. Same thing for Landon Donovan. And they can do that, but I don't think that's what I think of. And so when I think of the top three best strikers of all time for the United States, Josie's in that group.
Well, and Taylor, this actually brings up an interesting question, because I had Jozy Altidore first on my list as well, but the second line in my notes is not sure he's a national team legend, but he's 100% my answer here.
Yeah.
Because I do think he fills a big area of need and checks all the boxes. All the reasons that you said, Taylor, I had him on my list for the same thing. But it does make me wonder,
a tragic legend.
For you, Taylor, how many national team, U.S. men's national team legends are there? There's a lot for the U.S. women's national team. A lot of players that I think were really groundbreaking and set the stage for others to follow. For the men's national team, how many do you think there are? I'm curious.
Brexie.
I mean, that's the obvious one. You got to lead with that one.
Right.
It's interesting, Joe, because you're right. Like, in terms of legends for how good they were and how important they were, there aren't as many as you would think. Because I would say, like, Alexi Lalas, I would consider a U.S. men's national team legend, but I also think that's for the iconic hair and the goatee and for everything he's done since playing for the U.S. But I don't know if that makes him, like, a playing legend necessarily. So
sure.
It is a smaller pool. It's probably Brian McBride. It's Clint Dempsey. It's Landon Donovan. Maybe Eddie Pope. I think I would put Eddie Pope on that list. And then probably a lot of goalkeepers. Brad Friedel,
yeah,
Casey Keller, Tim Howard. I think all probably deserve some recognition. And then there's other ones who are like on the line of that one, like Ernie Stewart I would put in there. I would say Eric Winalda is in that sort of like second tier in my mind. There was somebody else who was, like Carlos Bocanegra, maybe, but that's where we get into that sort of like was good, but maybe never
sure.
at that like Reyna? Top tier level.
Claudio Reyna, is that what you said, Graham?
Claudio Reyna?
Yeah. Yeah. I think Reyna's definitely a legend.
Yeah,
he's probably
I mean,
on the Mount Rushmore.
There's just, it's an interesting question and one that I don't have an answer for either, Taylor. I was curious about your perspective. It is a small group of players that initially come to mind, and part of that for me is recency bias. But I'd be curious, it'd be an interesting episode for us to do at some point down the line, maybe to survey people, survey listeners to see who, it's all relative, right? This is all subjective to what people think and who they think of as legends, but I'd be curious to get a larger sample size and maybe we can talk about that at some point.
Steve Cherundolo, by the way, I can't believe I didn't say him earlier. Steve Cherundolo is absolutely a U.S. men's national team legend.
I think you meant mayor of Hanover, Steve Cherundolo.
I did. I apologize. Thank you,
Joe. Right. Clean it up.
Joe, did you finish with your answer there, Joe?
Yeah, Josie Altidore is my answer. Ryan, okay. I hear your criticism. I hear it too in my own head, but we're going to move on.
Very well. Graham, what did you get?
As the fan of a national team that was much better in decades gone by, can I just add all of our legends to the current pool of players? There is a lot of choice. I think I have the opposite problem, whereas there's a lot of choice for me to pick from. But I guess the obvious answer is Kenny Dalglish. He's still Scotland's joint record top scorer. He was one of the best players in the world at the time. I quite like Che Adams and Lyndon Dykes as Scotland centre-forwards right now, but let's face it, neither of them are Kenny Dalglish. And close second would be Dennis Law. Again, another forward. He shares that all-time scoring record with Dalglish for Scotland. He's the only Scottish player to have won the Ballon d'Or, at least until Aaron Hickey wins it in a few years' time. So between those two, I would happily take either of them. My third choice is nowhere near. I wanted to get a bit of variety so that there'd be better players than my third choice I'm about to name that in reality I would have in the team. But my third choice is nowhere near as good as Lord Dalglish. But let me explain. James McFadden, right? James McFadden was a decent Premier League player, but he produced his best football for Scotland. And there was a period when it was ridiculous how many big moments he produced. The qualification campaign for the Euro 2008, we were in a group with Italy and France, which were the World Cup finalists at that time, World Cup quarterfinalists in Ukraine, and we pushed Italy and France all the way down to that final game. And that was pretty much, that may be exaggerating slightly, but there was about six games in that campaign where James McFadden scored the winner or a brilliant goal or something like that. So he was a talisman, and I'd quite like one of those again. But yeah, I guess Dalglish or Law would be the obvious choice.
Good choices too, G. I say at the start of this question, I struggled with it because I read it as adding a player who would improve the team. I think logically that would be my reason for adding this player. And England are just so darn good. We're so deep. We've got so much all over the field. I joke. But I think the area I kind of looked at was midfield creativity, which over the last few years is something you could arguably say that England have lacked. But although arguably have gained a lot more of in recent years, think of James Maddison, Jack Grealish, Foden, Mason Mount, those kind of players do bring a spark of creativity. So I settled basically on my favourite England player. Graham, can you guess who it is from the 90s, creative player?
Is another one of my blonde brethren?
Yes, it is. It's Mr. Paul Gascoigne, of course, who brought a lot of fun, a lot of creative talent to the England side. I think he's the best England player of my lifetime, certainly when he was in his prime. And just maybe it's for nostalgia reasons in the 90s. I just thought he was absolutely wonderful, wonderful player. I think he's more creative than a lot of the midfield England options that we have, or attacking midfield, or number 10 options even. People like Conor Gallagher, Mason Mount, yes, all very good players, but they're not Paul Gascoigne, I suppose, would be my point. And I just think any situation gets better with Paul Gascoigne in it, frankly. So he would be my choice.
That's where my mind would go as well as an England fan. But as a second choice, what about centre-back? Because England have had some world-class central defenders, and while I don't think the England defence at the moment is terrible, Maguire and Stones, it feels like a John Terry or a Rio Ferdinand or going all the way back at a Bobby Moore or someone like that might improve that defence.
Yeah, that's very true. Or Terry Butcher or Bobby Moore or something like that. Yeah, I could definitely see it. Maybe JT, but I'd feel hard pushed to welcome John Terry back into any team for other reasons, I suppose. But yeah, that's a good point. Are you saying Stones and Maguire aren't good enough, Graham?
For England, but outside of England, I have questions about them.
Very well, very well. And valid questions they are. Anthony, thank you very much for that question. Plenty more when we come back after this short break.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our listener questions. Cigar Sierra Maggiore has got in contact and asked, would it be a good idea to allow players to wear earphones so that coaches can talk to them during the game? As coaches always seem to be shouting instructions in the stadium, would it be more efficient to do that through earphones? I'll start off, Joe, by saying that I would have been staunchly against this a few years ago, because for the sole reason that soccer is a simple game, and it's my belief that soccer should be the same at the very, very top level as it is in the park, or at the very lowest level where you and I might be playing it, because that's one of the main selling points of soccer to me. It's beautiful simplicity. But now, after we've had goal line technology, after we've had VAR, we have well established that top level soccer is a different game with different rules at the top level. So now I kind of feel, Joe, that the gate is open for this kind of thing, the floodgate even. I don't really see why we shouldn't trial earphones for players, maybe certain players, maybe a captain. What do you think, Joe?
I'm not opposed to it. Let's get the whole Brad Guzan MLS All-Star game of 3 years ago where he's just straight on the mic with the broadcast crew. Let's get that going. I think Cigar is asking a couple of different questions here. And Ryan, I hear your point. I think it's an interesting one. The first question is, would it be a good idea? The second question is, would it be more efficient? The answer to the second question is easy to provide. Yes, it would. Of course it would be. Right? It would change, I think, in some ways, how teams play, and it would change soccer because players could actually hear their manager. Soccer's interesting, right? Because you don't get timeouts. The hydration breaks have added a little bit of a wrinkle to this, and I think coaches probably really love those moments where you get a break 30 minutes in during the summer, and we don't see those a lot in Europe, but we see plenty of those in American soccer because they can take a chance to regroup. They can get the team and discuss key instructions for the last 15 minutes of a half. That's valuable because in soccer, you only get two timeouts. The one is before the game starts and the other one is at halftime, right? So there's not a lot of chances to communicate instructions, which does limit the impact a coach can have. And that's why it's so important to teach players how to problem solve and how to think about how to break down a team, how to think about how to solve things live as you're going on the fly. So I think this would change soccer in some ways. I don't know that I have a really strong preference on whether or not it would be a good idea. I'd be curious to see what it looks like. I don't think it would have a uniform effect on soccer at all levels or even within the same level. I think about Pep Guardiola getting on the mic and telling Calvin Phillips or whoever to do XYZ. That's going to have a much different effect than Adrian Heath getting on the mic. I know this is not the same level, but top division, Adrian Heath getting on the mic and telling his Minnesota United players to get stuck in, right? It's going to have a very different impact. I'd be curious to see what that looks like. Does it actually end up canceling out, or is there really that disparity? I would be curious to see, as I said, what this looks like. I'm not really itching for soccer to change much more than it already has, or at least not in this way. We can get rid of extra time first before we do this. But I'm intrigued. Let's put it that way. Taylor Graham, what do you guys think?
Have you ever tried running with AirPods in your ears? I feel like you might have to tape them in. Those yeah. things do not stay in there. So there's a logistical issue.
Also like balance issues that come from that, right? Where one ear has sound coming into it and yeah, it's going to be strange.
Yeah, exactly. I also have visions of like a silent disco and which players would be clever enough to somehow rewire the connection and just get like their Spotify playlist through their earphones instead and just ignore the coaches. And in fact, Coppa 90 did a video of this with Marco Reus and Axel Witsel, admittedly not coaches, but they got two players to instruct the two presenters how to play on the pitch through earphones. So it was the two professionals kind of instructing the two amateur presenters, like what to do and where to run and how to kick the ball and things like that. So You should search that out when you get a moment. It's pretty entertaining.
Graham, did that end with the presenters being constantly confused and looking at the guys who were giving them instructions to get further clarification?
Yeah, it did. Yep. So the thing is, one of the presenters who, if you watch football videos on YouTube, you might be familiar with, Timsy, Michael Timms, is really, really good. And Copper 90 used to get him to do a lot of the skills challenges. This made him so much worse. They should have just left him to his own devices. He did not need Axel Witsel in his ear. I don't think anyone does.
That's kind of where I am on this one. I get everything. I get all the positives that Ryan and Joe have mentioned. I think where it falls down for me, there's two things. First of all, like, I have an auditory processing issue. And if you have a hard time with sort of like distinguishing what's being said if there's a bunch of different stimuli at once, hearing crowd noise and your teammates and the opposition players and then all of a sudden getting a voice in your ear, I think would be a little bit alarming at times. But I also think, like, Julian Nagelsmann has talked about
how he wants... Wrap it up, please, Taylor. Wrap it up. This is the voice in your ear telling you to
see,
wrap it up.
See, there we go. Exactly. Now I'm pausing and be like, what? What's happening? Huh? What? Huh? No, but I think Julian Nagelsmann has said American football is far more technologically advanced than football or soccer. The quarterback has an earpiece to listen to his coach. We really need something like that. As a football coach, you can achieve a lot more with something like that. So Nagelsmann is on board. But I also think Nagelsmann is a person who loves to convey instructions and maybe at the same time isn't always thinking about, do his players want that instruction? And I think that would be the issue for me, is that when you see a quarterback getting instructions through that headset, like visualize that for a moment, and they're almost always putting their hands on the side of the helmet so they can cancel out all the other sound, and then they're kind of staring off into the middle distance while listening to the instruction, and then they call the play, or then they're listening and there's a little bit of back and forth. But it's in a moment of stoppage. It's in a moment when it's not as though as he snaps the ball, the coach is like, 88's open, 88's open. Like, it's not, I mean, I'm sure that's happening on the sidelines anyway, but I think the idea of, as you're sprinting back into defense for Jurgen Klopp to be in your ear, like, 2 yards to the left, 1 yard to the right, like, it would just end up being chaos, I think, for me. So if it was used sparingly as a, like, hey, we're making this adjustment, move to a back three, that's where I think it could totally,
like,
work.
Taylor, maybe you have three opportunities per half to get on the mic and someone else is controlling it and you have to ask for permission to speak. I think there could be fun ways to do this. It all feels a little gimmicky and seriously, like, all-star gamey, but maybe that's where it starts, and then we see it expanded from there.
You would need to pick your moments. You couldn't, like, Harry Kane just about to take a shot and Antonio Conte's on the microphone going, Harry! Just as he's about to... Actually, in F1, so that they can... The pit wall can talk to the drivers. And a couple of weeks ago, Carlos Sainz was overtaking... who was it? Checo Perez, the Red Bull driver, and Ferrari are on the radio to him as he's going right, like, wheel to wheel, and Carlos Sainz is going, not now, not now, which now I have visions of that happening in football. And actually, to be serious about this question for a moment, there is a related discussion going on in tennis about this. It's been going on for a few years about whether players should be... So in tennis, you're not allowed to receive any coaching from the sidelines. The WTA changed this, which is the women's tour. They changed this a couple of years ago, and so in their tournaments, you are now allowed to receive coaching. So I like in tennis how it's kind of down to the player to a certain extent to figure it out and down to match intelligence. And I guess I kind of also like that about football. So I'm not so keen, but from a gimmicky point of view, I very much want to see Antonio Conte shouting at Harry Kane just as he's about to take a penalty.
To be fair though, Graham, in the Wimbledon final, Nick Kyrgios was having a very open dialogue with his bench. If there was an earpiece in, maybe the whole game would, or the match would have been a bit more peaceful, but I get your point there. I think the reason I stand in favour of it is because if I were a professional soccer player, I think I'd genuinely struggle to take instruction 40 yards away in a packed stadium from an angry person waving their arms. And I think I'd find that information in my ear easier to handle. I think, Taylor, you're saying the kind of same thing with the auditory processing. Is that fair?
No, I'm saying the opposite of that. I think it would be way, way harder to get instruction in your ear. I think it'd be very distracting. And I even went as far as to think, we're going to talk about Jurgen Klopp later on Soccer 101 and about how good he seems to be at that individual man management and knowing when to make a joke versus when to be kind of intense and screamy. And even making a joke, as I'm like running back to defend a corner for him to be like, hey, that guy's not very good. It was just like, whoa, what's happening now? Like, I think I would constantly feel like I had, I guess, like a Klopp on my shoulder, which maybe is a fun product that we should market. If we're going to change the game in a way that allows coaches to communicate better, like if that's a thing we're doing, I've always sort of enjoyed the art in basketball of knowing when to call a timeout when your team is starting to lose the momentum or has lost the momentum, and that timeout sort of like cools the other team off and allows things to reset. And I think that could be an interesting wrinkle. It would be controversial because it would deliberately destroy the flow of the game, but that would be a thing that you'd have to consider. But I like the idea of a team being overwhelmed and needing to use their one timeout per half to sort of reset things and hope that they can make the necessary adjustment. I think that puts it more on the manager to be a better communicator in that moment, whereas I think a lot of coaches would end up relying on it and would end up constantly talking to players, and I could see that being distracting. Yeah. I also don't know how you would know which one you're supposed to talk to. So I think it would inevitably lead to, I don't know why I keep going with Jurgen Klopp.
Like a mixing board in front of on the touchline.
Yeah. I wanted Van Dijk. I did want Firmino. Like,
2 yards to the left. No, not you. I meant the other one.
I hit the wrong button again. That's on me.
You'd end up with him slagging off Thiago and it going into Thiago's ear. Coach, you hurt my feelings. There'll be all kinds of problems there as well. Whether we agree or not on the earphone situation, can we all agree, gents, that we should have body cams on all the players, as we did in that Milan versus FC Cologne friendly a couple weeks back where the Cologne players were wearing body cams and we got this kind of video game footage? It looked absolutely incredible. Not only was it great for a viewing experience, but I imagine for coaches, that kind of information, seeing what the players see, could be kind of useful too. What do you think, Joe?
I'm here for it, Ryan. More technology in soccer. Let's replace all the players with robots. Then we're really cooking with gas.
Yeah.
Holograms.
Then we make the teams NFTs like Barcelona, and we're all set. We don't need
Ryan,
people at all.
That's your second NFT reference. Do you have money in NFTs? Is that what's happening here? Are you slowly trying to build that industry?
Maybe you're used to it and they're not worth anything anymore, Taylor. What's it to you? Anyway, thank you very much, Cigar, for that question. Let's go to Guy Yedweb, who says, when Julian Nagelsmann coached Gnabry on loan at Hoffenheim, and Guy says he was scouting at that time, they played in a 3-5-2 with Gnabry as a second striker. In the past, before Sadio Mane, Bayern Munich considered Gnabry their best Lewandowski backup. What would it take, asks Guy, for Bayern Munich to implement that kind of 3-5-2, and would it work? Joe Lowry, if my memory serves me correct, Bayern were in a 4-2-3-1 for the Super Cup. There was no back three. What do you think about this one?
Yeah, so Graham talked about that game and talked about it as a 4-2-2-2, right, with kind of a dual striker formation with two attacking midfielders underneath. But they did use a 4-2-3-1 for large stretches of last year. We also saw super aggressive back three shapes, but nothing that to my mind at least looked a lot like a 3-5-2. So this would be a little bit of a new thing for Julian Nagelsmann at Bayern. I don't think it's impossible for them to use a 3-5-2. So I'm going to walk us through it a little bit here. I think Serge Gnabry totally works as a second striker and can play off another nine very well. More on that, though, in just a second. So let's start from the back and build forward. I think Bayern are still maybe a little light on center back depth. Maybe they're okay, but De Ligt is there at least. So they have the quality to go to a back three. Alphonso Davies and Mazraoui can play as the wing backs without any issue. Joshua Kimmich can play as the number six, and you can either go for a real 3-5-2 or you can kind of go for a 3-4-1-2 with Thomas Müller as that number 10 behind the front two. You can do this in a few different ways, and then you get to the front line, and if we want to pencil Serge Gnabry in as one of the forwards, I don't really know who you pair him with, and that's where this gets difficult for me and where I start to think that this isn't likely, at least with Sadio Mane as the other number nine. I think it gets difficult here because Serge Gnabry works when he can be the one running in behind and playing off of another number nine who maybe does the more traditional number nine things, like dropping in, occasionally holding the ball up, being not necessarily a bigger body, but just doing contrasting things. So you have these counter movements with one dropping in, one running in behind, or one standing firm and one running in behind, or running underneath and then moving in behind. I think that works, but I don't know that it works with Mane. I'm not saying it couldn't work in the right circumstances, but in a classic 3-5-2 or just two striker setup, I don't think Mane is different enough from Serge Gnabry. I don't think they're different enough from each other. Mane, I think, is much more of the, okay, I'm going to drop in occasionally, get the ball to feet. I can hold up the ball a little bit, but I'm going to run in behind and find space in the box and turn and go. And for me, that's pretty much what Serge Gnabry would look like and does look like when he plays forward anywhere, really, on the front line, winger or as a more central attacker. So if we're seeing Choupo-Moting start up top as a number nine, which has happened before for Bayern Munich, and it will happen again this season, getting Choupo-Moting and Mane up top together or him and Serge Gnabry up top together, that to me fits better from a player profile standpoint than getting Mane, who I think we all agree is going to be, at least right now, Bayern Munich starting number nine as we head into the season, whether that's as a lone nine or as part of a dual striker shape, I don't know. But for now, I think it might make more sense for Gnabry to be on the wing whenever Sadio Mane is playing as the number nine for this team.
Could it work with Thomas Müller getting pushing him further forward into? I mean, I know it's not maybe his best position to play as a centre forward, but he has played there previously in his career. So maybe you have Mane as the apex, and then have one like Gnabry or Mane kind of buzzing around him, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't that just end up though being like more of the 4-2-3-1? I guess forget what the back line looks like, but if you have Mane up top and then you're trying to pair Müller with him in this instance, it's just going to look like a 9 in a 10 with then Serge Gnabry coming in from the wing, and I don't think you're really changing all that much. And if you do want to play Mane and Müller up top together or Müller and Gnabry up top together, I think you lose out, especially with Gnabry and Müller. Mane maybe can do it. I think you lose out on some of the ability to hold the ball up. Thomas Müller is just going to drift and kind of go where he wants to define the game. Not as a traditional number 10, but he's still going to pop up in different pockets of space. And Gnabry is just going to go vroom, vroom and run in behind. And you don't really have any outlet there. And for Bayern Munich, against a low block, this might be the recipe, right? It might not matter if you have a guy who can hold the ball up and really play the ball to feet, because you're going to get Thomas Müller doing that stuff. You're going to get Joshua Kimmich doing that stuff, and there's going to be Musiala doing it, and you're going to be funneling the ball out wide. So I'm not saying this stuff couldn't work. I'm not saying the 3-5-2 with Gnabry up top with somebody won't work either. I just don't know that from a profile standpoint it makes the most sense right out of the gate for Julian Nagelsmann.
T-Rock, anything to add to this one? Would a 3-5-2 affect the month in which Bayern win the Bundesliga?
Maybe it makes it a little bit later, because I think it doesn't work quite as well as what they're going to do this season. I think Joe has given a great answer, because I found this one sort of hard to answer, because my original answer was, I think a lot of times you see teams go to a back three when they don't trust some of their midfielders or the midfield depth. And so my original answer was basically Barcelona need worse players. I think Joe has done a good job of explaining why really it's about how they would need a better strike partner. And so if we're like answering this question as it's asked, I think my answer is what would it take? It would take them going back in time and signing Mazraoui last season. Because when they did play with a back three last season, I believe Gnabry was used as one of those wingbacks and it did not work out for him. So even in this time when they did use that back three, he was a wingback and not a central or like a secondary striker. And I wonder if they had Mazraoui or even Dest, if Dest had gone to Bayern, if that would have been a thing we would have seen given the familiarity between Gnabry and Nagelsmann. But they didn't, so we didn't. But I think Joe has nailed it with why we won't see that anytime soon. I think it could be really interesting, and I think Serge Gnabry is an excellent player. Wherever you put him, just maybe not wing back.
I think it works with the defense in the midfield. It's the attack that I have trouble with. I'm not sure how that would look.
All right, thank you very much, Guy, for that question. Let's take a very quick break. When we come back, we're talking tall players. Back soon.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our listener questions. Andrew McPherson has got on the line and said, between Ryan and John Green, I've become pretty aware of the all-important news from AFC Wimbledon.
Aww.
The Wimbly Womblies recently signed Kyle Hudlin, who is 6'11", or just over two metres if we're going metric. John Green's absolute joy at the signing of a new small bottom big made me wonder, who are the tallest players ever in pro soccer? Andrew is absolutely true. Kyle Hudlin has signed for AFC Wimbledon this season. He came from Huddersfield via Solihull Moors. He is, by my reckoning, Graham, the tallest active outfield player in the current soccer world. I found a Danish goalkeeper who plays in the English lower leagues called Simon Jorgensen, who is also 6'11". But obviously he's a goalkeeper, and it tends to be, Graham, that outfield players aren't quite as tall as that.
Yeah, so I found a couple goalkeepers. I found Christophe Van Hoot, who is a 6'10 Belgian goalkeeper, plays for Westerlo in Belgium. He is a giant, and I've decided all I want in life now is a picture of him and Sebastian Giovinco standing next to each other at a corner. That is all I want. So if someone can make that happen, thank you very much. I found another Danish goalkeeper, Tony Brogaard, played in Denmark. An outfield player, I found Paul Miller, whose name is a name I'm actually familiar with, because he played in the Scottish lower leagues. I'm pretty sure he would have played against Stirling Albion at some point. He played for Elgin City, who famously had to heighten the entrance to their dressing room at Borough Briggs to make room for Paul Miller. I have been in that dressing room at Borough Briggs, and it doesn't surprise me that they had to make modifications for a 6'10" player. It is very cramped in there, but I actually couldn't find a player that was as tall as the Wibbly Womblies' new number 9.
Wibbly Womblies. How do we feel about that as a team name, Graham?
So I hadn't heard that before, and I also hadn't heard of the term small bottom big, so I did wonder if we were actually speaking English anymore.
John Greenisms, these are John Green, the authors, you know, who sponsors one of the stands at a Plough Lane. In fact, he sponsored one at Kingsmeadow. And Andrew added in his question that most of his Wimbledon news comes from John Green's podcast, Dear Hank and John, where the two brothers talk with one another. It isn't a soccer podcast, but it's a delight, says Andrew. I don't know how I feel about promoting other podcasts as I just did there, but I agree with the sentiment there entirely. Yeah, apparently there are. Apparently other people do this thing. That was news to me also. Yeah. Graham. Yeah. Taylor, tall players.
I had Kyle Hudlin as 6'11", though he is also listed at 6'9 and 6'10". It seems like there is a little bit of difference based on where you're getting your sources. Simon Block Jorgensen, Graham, did you mention him?
I didn't.
He's 6'11", German-born Danish goalkeeper. I love that as I read these lists, it really depends on when they're published, because I know I had Christoph Van Hout, who I'm assuming, Graham mentioned him, is also related to Milhouse Van Houten. When they immigrated, maybe they added the N or the EN on the end. But like when I read the article about
his mom says it's cool.
Him being listed as number one, he was the tallest player. Then Block Jorgensen was named the tallest player. And then now I've seen Kyle Hudlin listed as the tallest player ever in history. So I'm not really sure which random website I should go with, but I think 6'11 is about the tallest we've seen.
Yeah, you guys might remember in our Total Soccer Show Slack, I sent a picture of Hudlin a couple weeks back.
When
flanked by AFC Wimbledon staff members, and he's like twice their size. It is quite crazy, and it reminded me. When I was a young lad, I saw Peter Crouch play for QPR when he was a teenager, and just how different he looks compared to the other players because of his sheer height and sort of gangliness. And I do wonder whether there's a point where height becomes a disadvantage in the mechanics of being an outfield soccer player.
No doubt.
Obviously a big advantage for a goalkeeper, but I don't know. What do you think, Joe?
I mean, there's a reason why we don't see, why it's rare to see a big man in the NBA with great ball handling skills or elite quickness. Those players do exist, and the ones that do have both of those things are oftentimes legends. I think about Kevin Durant, who's a giant dude, but somehow is still incredibly athletic and incredibly quick and coordinated. That stuff's just rare. And I think in soccer, when it's not even like you can grow in coordination by using your hands every single day. No, it's feet, and it's much more of a rare skill. It's a weird thing to try and go out and do something with your feet all the time, like playing soccer. When you're tall and you're just a lot more gangly, it's much more difficult. So the amount of success that Peter Crouch was able to have is incredibly impressive to me. And then also you get any of these players that were able to actually make it up into a decent level in professional soccer. I mean, doing that at any height above 6'5 or 6'6 as an outfield player is, or even a goalkeeper those goalkeepers need incredible lateral quickness and reaction time and coordination. Doing that as a tall person is really hard. So I have a lot of respect for all of these players.
Yeah, I think my guess would be like the average NBA height is, I don't know, probably like 6'6. I think the average, like if you looked around the globe, the average height for a soccer player, I'm guessing it's closer to like 5'8 or 5'9 is the average. Like it's strange when you do see players in person. I remember one of the first games I covered was a preseason Milan game, and there was Gennaro Gattuso. And you expect him to be like 9 feet tall because he just has that personality and that energy.
He's tiny,
He's pretty small. Like, and I think that is pretty much par for the course. I think players tend to be a little bit shorter and very, very light because that allows them to run and run and run and run. So I agree with Joe. I think at a certain point, even with goalkeepers, height not necessarily that big of an advantage.
Erling Haaland is 6'5", right? And he seems like a giant. Can you imagine what it's like to be a 6'11" number nine, like the one that Wimbledon have just signed?
Joe's going to get on my shoulders, and then we're going to figure out what that is.
Yeah, yep. That's the point. Bring it on.
I would also like to see a manager play a joke on the rest of the team after they sign a 6'11" striker first training session with the guy, and he's gathered all the players around, and they're like, right, okay, we're going to play it into this guy's feet. We're going to get him turned. We're going to use his pace. Just use everything besides the most obvious aspect of his game. Yeah. Okay. Always on the floor into this guy. Yeah.
I think the key difference, Graham, with Erling Haaland is that he's also 6'5" wide. That makes a difference, whereas Hudlin is quite a lot slimmer than that. So yeah, quite a frightening proposition. But thank you, Andrew, for that question. Let's go to Preston Chitty, who is inspired by Taylor's, he calls it a lazy rendition of the Janazai song last week. Hurtful, I know. What player chant lives rent-free in your head and you relish a chance to sing along to it? For example, Preston says he sung the Sucker and Emile Smith Rowe chant far too many times to count last season, along with every other Arsenal fan. Bonus points to anybody who sings their pick, apart from me, apparently, because I would enjoy that too much, says Preston.
Yeah.
Which is very true. Graham, what do you think about this one?
So if you ask me, the best player chant of all time was the one for Bobby Zamora, which is to the tune of That Zamora, and it goes, when the ball hits the goal, it's not Shearer or Cole, it's Zamora, which is absolutely brilliant. But even better was when the opposition fans would adapt it to, when the ball hits your head and you're sat in Rosette, it's Zamora. And that, for me, is football terrace banter at its absolute
best. Oh,
that's
so good. That is so good, Graham.
Yeah, that is excellent. Joe, any nominations for a chant and bonus points for singing?
So I had a really hard time with this one, and I wanted to contribute and be fun and have something beautiful to sing. Taylor, and I wanted to get your perspective on this. Are player chants a real thing in American soccer? Like I'm trying to think of games. I've never heard a player chant at a game that I've attended. Let me put it that way. The most of the soccer games I've been to in my life are Phoenix Rising games, and there were chants for the team coming from the supporter section, but I never heard there, and maybe this has changed since the last time I've been because it's been at least a year, maybe two, but I never heard a player chant. And I don't know. I feel like I'm not able to properly contribute to this question in particular. I know I have heard some in my life of player chants, but none of them live even close to rent-free in my head. There's a lot of catchy ones, and now Grahams is going to be living in there for quite some time. But it's not. Is it that much of a thing in the United States? Taylor, tell me.
I don't think so. I think it's probably is for teams that have a particular legend or a particularly important player. I think you might get that more. Again, I'm not speaking as an expert on that one either because I'm not spending every week in MLS supporter sections. But I do think when you get them, they tend to be, in my mind, versions of songs that are sung about other players,
sure.
The kind of common ones to a common beat that then you just make about that player. But yeah, I don't think we have necessarily as clever ones that come to mind. I think the Kickers have like one or two for certain players, the Richmond Kickers here in Richmond. But yeah, I think it is less of a common thing for sure.
Darn. Well, I'm going to do my homework, Preston, and I'm going to find one that I like between now and the end of the season. And when that happens, I will make sure to let you know.
I think for me, my favorite that I always come back to is the West Ham fans who were at Anfield many a year ago, and Jonjo Shelvey was warming up for Liverpool on the sideline, and they started singing, "He's coming for you, he's coming for you, Harry Potter, he's coming for you." And it was quite well taken by Jonjo Shelvey. He seemed to enjoy it. He gave them a clap for it. There's a clip of it on YouTube. But I love those spur of the moment ones where it's clearly someone who's just invented it on the spot. Those are typically my favorites. And I think the tune that I think is a fairly modern soccer chant tune that gets stuck in my head the most, and I think it's the most suitable soccer tune, melody, I should say, that is used in chants, is Seven Nation Army. And I always think of, Thiago Silva, as the name being associated with that. But obviously, there are hundreds of names you could put in that. So that's the one that I think is the biggest earworm for me. And I like those spur of the moment ones.
Along a similar line, it's not particularly witty, and there's actually no real lyrics to it, but I always liked the Falcao song that Atletico Madrid fans used to sing, and I think Man United fans sang it as well, but obviously very, very fleetingly. He was only there for one season, but it basically just goes, lo 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 lo, Radamel Falcao, lo 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 lo, lo 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 lo, Radamel Falcao, and hearing 50,000 Atleti fans singing that, and it just gets louder and louder and louder, and it repeats and repeats and repeats, and it can go on for like 20 minutes, and that's always one of my favourites. As I say, not clever or witty or funny, but just as an earworm, when I hear Falcao's name, I always think of that song.
And Graham, surely belonging to that genre, or perhaps belonging to that genre, was the Colo and Yaya Toure song the Manchester City fans would sing. So it was to the tune of a hard house Dutch band called Two Unlimited. They had a song called No Limit in the 90s. And they go, Colo, Colo, Colo,
Colo, Colo, Colo, Colo, Colo,
Colo,
Colo, Colo, Colo, Colo, Toure, yeah. I love that song.
There you go. That one, and that can go on for hours. Brilliant.
My daughter sings that because we sing it in our house. Even though it's about Man City, I find that song to be that catchy that she knows that one.
And that one like transcended soccer as well in the UK. So I've not been to a club in a while, but there was a time, a younger period of my life, where you'd go to a club and people would be doing that chant. It took root in British culture, not just the soccer.
And it had a dance. And it had a dance.
It does. Ryan, I was going to say that's the best part of it for me when I'm singing it with my daughter, is that she knows, she's not yet two, but she knows the Colo part, you go down, and for the Yaya part, the hands go up. That's her favorite part of it, is ducking down for the Colo part and then standing back up with her hands in the air for Yaya. I love that song. That's a great one, Ryan.
Strangely as it has, I have two nieces who I'm visiting here in the UK, and the youngest calls, the eldest is called Sophia, and her sister calls her Yaya. So I did the Colo Yaya song for them yesterday, and they enjoyed it very much indeed. Taylor, any more to add?
Yeah, first of all, laziness. I have to take issue with that one. Laziness is the word. I would go with Taylor's awkward rendition because his singing voice is terrible. We can't all be Ryan Bailey. I have a Turkish song that is about Galatasaray, not about a player, that I learned phonetically that will forever be in my head because I took that amount of time to learn it. But the one that is currently in my head, pretty much on rotation, is the Erik ten Hag song. I think I sent you all the video of the Man United fans singing it. But one hog, two hogs, three hogs, four hogs, five hogs, six hogs, seven hogs, eight hogs, nine hogs, ten hog, Ten Hag, and it goes on. I love that one a lot. And I think similar to Graham's, like whenever there's one that's like it's clever, but it's simple and it's funny. I think that's what you want when it comes to terrace chanting. So I'll go with the Ten Hag song for sure.
Wonderful stuff. May we hear it many a time this season, T-Rock. That just about wraps up listener questions. Or does it? Bonus Graham content time, everybody. Raphael Boban has got in touch with a question for Graham, who says, Raphael says, our daughter will be attending university in Scotland over the next 4 years. Ooh, 4-year course. We'd like to visit the not so well-known stadiums or venues in the Scottish Premiership that are perhaps special in some way. It could be the setting, the environment, the atmosphere. We're looking for something off the beaten track that would be normally overlooked by most folks. In other words, doesn't want to go to Celtic or Rangers, Graham. So Raphael's asking, what would you recommend there? Well, Raphael being brave and his daughter being brave to hang with the wildlings above the wall. So what would you recommend while they're there?
I'll have you know, Ryan, that we have some of the best universities in the world. I'd imagine that's why Raphael's daughter is coming over here for 4 years. Anyway.
Harry or William, didn't they go to St. Andrews? I'm pretty sure.
St. Andrews, indeed. And my wife. You know, that's actually the three people that they mention all the time. They say Prince William, Kate Middleton, and my wife. Yeah,
there you go.
So, football recommendations. If it's atmosphere you're looking for, try and go to Hearts home game at Tynecastle. Tynecastle is a brilliant stadium. I would say it's maybe the best stadium in Scottish football. The stands are right on top of the pitch. It's a good mix of historic but also a little bit modern. They've got a brand new main stand. It's big enough that the crowd feels important, but not so big that it's overwhelming. And it's in an area of Edinburgh, Gorgie, which is surrounded by fantastic pubs and places to just soak up the atmosphere pre and post match. So I would recommend Hearts. Also, Hearts are pretty decent at the moment. They're going to be in European competition this season. Motherwell is also a very nice stadium to visit. They've got an ultra section, which isn't quite Serie A levels, but they make a good noise. And Fir Park is certainly a very characterful stadium. It has two very old stands. The main stand, weirdly, doesn't stretch the full length of the pitch, because the story there is that when they were building it, the house behind that stand objected to the new stand blocking sunlight into their garden. So you have these three big stands and then this 1 3-quarter length stand, which is kind of weird, but a good place to visit. If you're looking for something very much off the beaten track in Scottish soccer, and this isn't Scottish Premiership, but I'm going to give you a couple of lower league recommendations as well. Try going to a Brechin City game at Glebe Park. It's arguably my favourite away ground in Scotland. Brechin are in the Highland League right now, so don't expect high level of soccer. It'll be a small crowd, but it's got a quirky little main stand. One side of the pitch is a hedge, and that hedge forced UEFA to change their rules. Basically, they brought in rules about 15 years ago that said you couldn't have a hedge at the side of a pitch, and Brechin appealed it and won. So the hedge stayed, and it's still there to this day. And they do, obviously, the most important thing of any football match, going to a football match, is the food. They do wonderful soup and pies and sausage rolls, and it's in Angus. So no matter where you are in Scotland, it's far enough away that you feel like you've had a proper day out, but not really that much of a mission. And sticking in Angus, I would have to also mention Arbroath. They play right on the edge of the North Sea, so bring a warm jacket, but it's a wonderful community club. They're doing really well right now, so it's a good place. You know, it's not a toxic club right now. Some clubs in Scotland you can go to, and it's a very angry atmosphere. I don't think that's the case at Arbroath at the moment. I haven't been to Gayfield in a while, but it's one of my favourite away grounds. So those are my recommendations.
Good stuff, Graham. Now, we've established I don't care much for the north of the UK because it's cold, wet and full of garbage people.
We have.
If Raphael and or his daughter wish to go a little further south, below the wall, to Newcastle. I think there's a straight road. There's a highway from Edinburgh to Newcastle. How easy a trip would that be? Because Newcastle is one of my favourite cities in the world. Brilliant people, amazing stadium to visit.
Yes, I have done that trip a number of times. So the three kind of stadiums in England that I've been to plenty of times are St James's Park, Goodison Park, Old Trafford. They're all fairly easy to get to from Scotland. Obviously, Everton and Man United is a little bit further, but Newcastle United, just head down the A1 from the east coast of Scotland, from Edinburgh, as you say there, Ryan. St James's Park is one of the most atmospheric grounds in English football and in world football, actually. And also the ground is right on, they call it the cathedral. They either call it the cathedral on the hill or the cathedral on top of the hill. It basically is perched on the top of Newcastle. It's right in the city centre. There's loads of pubs around it. Newcastle fans are really passionate. So yeah, absolutely would recommend that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And for any American visitor, I think if you are going to leave London, if you visit England or the UK, then Newcastle will be my first pick for the reasons outlined. And some excellent recommendations there from you as well, Graham. Thank you very much. That concludes our listener questions episode for the day. Graham, once again, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
Joe Lowry, pleasure as always.
Right back at you, Ryan.
And Taylor Rockwell, thank you so much. Let us know if any chupacabras are in your vicinity. We'll be there with our vigilante group to help.
I shall do my best. If you don't hear from me, then the chupacabra got me, which means I guess I am also part goat, which is troubling for a different reason.
Wonderful stuff. Listener, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back on the feed shortly. But for now, bye.